From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a black South African photojournalist, Peter Magubane has been celebrated and punished for his work. During the years he documented life under apartheid, he was imprisoned, tortured, and banned. Now he's documenting the new South Africa for Time magazine. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Peter Magubane about his work. Also, Michael Oakes plays some favorite early rock and roll obscurities. Oakes runs a music and photo archive. Just about every music book and documentary uses pictures from it. Oakes has a new book devoted to album covers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Senate Democrats say they will work around the clock tonight to call attention to the need for disaster relief. President Clinton vetoed the measure because Republicans refused to strip it of unrelated provisions. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Vice President Al Gore joined congressional Democrats today in demanding a disaster relief bill the president can sign. Gore likened Republican tactics to the budget negotiations in 1995 that led to two government shutdowns. He accused Republicans of holding the aid hostage.
This is a colossal mistake. This is not complicated. People in this nation see through this. Stop it.
Republicans have refused to strip the bill of a provision that would ban the Census Bureau from using a method aimed at improving the minority count, and another measure that would keep the government funded at low levels in case of a stalemate over the budget. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Defense Secretary William Cohen will begin considering new names to become candidates for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Leading candidate General Joseph Ralston withdrew his name from consideration yesterday after controversy arose over an admitted adulterous affair several years ago. Some names being mentioned as possible candidates include Admiral Joseph Lopez, NATO's Southern Flank Commander, Army General Wesley Clark, and Marine Corps Commandant General Charles Krulak. The current Joint Chiefs Chairman, John Shalikashvili, plans to retire in September. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is urging Congress to renew China's most favored nation trading status. She says failure to do so could jeopardize warming relations between the two countries.
Severing normal trade relations is such an extreme step that it would slam into reverse the current trend towards greater engagement with China and propel us downhill towards hostility and confrontation. This would severely damage America's strategic interests.
Critics have called for an end to China's MFN status, as it's known, pointing to Beijing's repression of civil liberties and poor human rights record. Albright acknowledges the United States is troubled by China's actions, but says engagement is not endorsement. She says engaging China will have a liberalizing effect on political and human rights practices. Tropical storm Blanca is moving up Mexico's southern Pacific coast today. There are strong winds and heavy rain, particularly in the resort town Hualtuco. That's 325 miles southwest of Mexico City. The Mexican government is sending storm warnings from Port Angel to Acapulco and has closed several ports. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 73 points at 7,551. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, the stock market is rallying to record levels for a third consecutive session. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are expressing confidence that the economy can continue to enjoy moderate growth without producing higher inflation. This week's surveys on producer prices and retail sales are expected to support that notion. With the perception, then, that interest rates will remain stable, rate-sensitive stocks are higher. The most active issue on the New York Exchange is an initial public offering in Santa Fe International. Its shares have gained more than 10%. The offshore oil drilling company is being spun off from Kuwait Petroleum Corp. And shares in Boeing are higher after Continental Airlines placed a $4 billion order with Boeing and made the company its sole supplier for 20 years. I'm Doug Krisner.
British Airways says it will invest some $10 billion in new aircraft, facilities, products, services, and training over the next 3 years, and plans to buy 43 new aircraft from Boeing over the same time period. PepsiCo has announced former company president Andrel Pearson will be its new chairman and CEO of its restaurant unit, which will soon be spun off. The unit features Pizza Hut, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Taco Bell restaurants. This unit has drained off some Pepsi earnings recently. The new unit, which has yet to acquire a name, is worth some $10 billion. An Australian paper reports Mobile Corporation's getting ready to sell some Australian assets worth $300 million. The assets came from Mobile's purchase of Ampolex, an Australian oil and gas firm. Ampolex was attractive because it controlled several gas fields offshore northwestern Australia. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a black South African photojournalist, Peter Magabane risked his life during the days of apartheid to document what was really happening in his country. He took pictures of the Sharpeville massacre in 1960 and the Soweto uprising in 1976. He was the first black South African to win a photography award in his country, but he was also punished by the government for his work with imprisonment, torture, solitary confinement, and a 5-year banning order. Now he's documenting life in the new South Africa for Time magazine. Last week, Peter Magabane was honored with the Mother Jones Leica Lifetime Achievement Award, given jointly by the Mother Jones Magazine International Fund for Documentary Photography and the Leica Camera Group. I asked Peter Magabane about a photo taken June 18, 1976, in Alexandra as the Soweto uprising spread to other townships. In the photo, two women are screaming. The older woman is physically supporting the younger one, who has just lifted up her T-shirt, revealing a bullet wound that has ripped open her abdomen.
It was the morning on the 18th of June when I decided to go to Alexander Township after learning that the police have entered Alexander Township to stop people from demonstrating. So when I got there, I walked around, and the first thing I did was I went to the nearby beer hall where everything was happening. There were these two women who were standing not far away from me. I was taking pictures of them as they got excited and excited. The next thing I saw, in fact, I had a shot from behind me which oozed past my ear and pierced this woman's stomach. Fortunately, she didn't fall, and there was someone to help her, and I was there to take the pictures. I just kept on shooting. I didn't stop shooting. After that, the woman was rushed to hospital. Whether she did survive or not, I don't know.
So this bullet that struck her whizzed right past you and nearly struck you?
Yes, it did.
Did you feel it going by?
No, I just had the ooze sound, ooh, past me, you know. And I, after taking one shot, I fell to the ground. I got up again and continued taking pictures of this woman screaming.
You were nearly wounded while taking this photo. Were you ever wounded during protests that you were photographing?
Well, yes, June 16, long after that, I was my nose was fractured in Alexander Township by a police captain who wanted me to expose my film of pictures that I had been taking of the police beating up people. When I refused, he hit me on the face, fracturing my nose. I didn't feel that pain. The pain that I felt was to be made to expose my film into light and lose the images that would be history today. That was more painful to me than the shot that I got on my nose, because at least I knew that with my nose it could be taken care of. But the images that I lost, I couldn't recapture those images.
So it sounds like you had a double sense of purpose. One was to document what was happening then and expose that to the world. But the other was to preserve those images for history so that people would remember what happened.
Yes, it was more. It was important for me to document for history, and also important for me to document for the outside world to know what is going on in South Africa, how apartheid is operating, so that people in other countries can apply pressure on South Africa, which was the theme at the time. And of course, countries around the world did apply pressure when seeing some of our images that came from South Africa.
You have a whole book of photos on the Soweto uprising. The uprising in 1976 started as a student protest against the compulsory use of Afrikaans language in the classroom. And that spread into just like larger riots of protest. And those riots started in Soweto, spread to other townships, and were met with police massacres of people who were protesting. When did you enter the scene?
The very first day of June 16, I was there. In fact, I helped the press go in, because the students didn't want the press to come in at the time, fearing that the photographs that I'd taken would be used by the police to identify them. But I strongly said to the students that an uprising without documentation is no cause at all. You needed to have people that would record what you're doing, so that the world can see if you are mowed down by the police or whatever soldiers come in. They should see how you are being killed, and your relatives and parents should also be able to identify you when you are missing, if you have been captured in the pictures. And of course, they did agree, and I said it should not only be black journalists that are allowed. Everyone that is a journalist has an important part to play. And they did let in all kinds of people to document the struggle.
The students were first worried that any photographs you took could be used against them, because the police could identify them from the photographs. Do you know if your photographs were ever used that way by the police?
No. I know, for instance, when I was working for the Rand Daily Mail, that the police wanted all pictures taken on June 16. But I told my editor, Raymond Lowe, that under no circumstances should my pictures be released. Fortunately, I had all the pictures with me and the contact prints and everything, so there was nothing in the office that the police could lay their hands on.
Did you hide them?
No, I didn't hide them. I just kept them at home. I knew that I was not going to release them. Under no circumstances would I have released them.
How did you learn to get around with your camera in the middle of riots?
Well, I didn't need any education at all. One says to himself, "Here you are. You want to document this. So you go into the crowd and look around and see how safe you are. Once you realize that you are safe, but in South Africa you're never safe because the police are always watching. So what you do is you are watching what you are photographing, and at the same time you are watching who is following you. So you had two things to do. In most cases, you had to hide your camera, your cameras. I operated with two cameras, a 35mm and a 105 lens. Didn't use any big lenses because that would have exposed me to the police. The police would have been able to see me from afar. And I was able to work with those two cameras. Sometimes I would put them in underneath my dust coat or under my jacket and operate under those circumstances.
Did a black man with a camera just automatically spell trouble for the police?
Not necessary. Not necessary. Any person that is having a camera those days, he was or she was known as an enemy of the state, because they knew very well that the material that we were taking was not only for South African consumption, it was also for the world at large.
There are several pictures of people who have been tear gassed and who are temporarily disabled by that. I'm wondering how you were able to use your eyes to take photographs when people are being blinded by the tear gas around you.
Well, I had learned not to rub my eyes, never to use water, but just to try and close my eyes. Sometimes I would shoot closing my eyes. You know, I don't know how I got other pictures focused, but some are a little bit out of focus. But it is not the sharpness of the picture that makes the picture. It is the contents in the picture. So I was able to succeed in beating the tear gas.
My guest is black South African photojournalist Peter Magubane. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. South African photographer Peter Magubane is my guest, and he documented the apartheid-era protests. Now he's documenting post-apartheid South Africa for Time magazine. There are two photographs of you being arrested by the police. I wonder who took the photos and what was your reaction when yourself being documented?
Well, it was good for a change that there was someone to document when I was being manhandled and arrested by the police. Otherwise, the world would not have seen how difficult I had to operate under. It was not only that arrest. There have been several arrests. There has been the detention of 1969, where I was detained for 586 days and banned for 5 years, which meant I could no longer practice as a photographer because I wasn't allowed to interact with more than one person. I wasn't allowed to leave Diep Kloof, where I am, which is a small suburb. I had to report to the police once a week. You know, it was difficult for one to operate, which means, I have lost something like 7 years of my photographic career. Then in 1985, I was shot with 17 buckshots below my waist, which are still embedded in my body. I was left for dead. Had it not been for the children that had come to bury their colleague, I probably wouldn't be alive today.
Who shot you? How were you shot?
I was shot by the police. The police came and just opened fire on the crowd that was standing there. This was at a funeral in Natal Spruit. The person that was running in front of me, he was hit, I don't know where, what part of the body, but he collapsed in front of me and never regained consciousness, and he died. Fortunately, I was pulled into this house by the students who were there.
I think most of the 586 days that you were in prison, you were in solitary, is that right?
Yes.
How did you keep your sanity during that period? That's a really long time.
Well, the first 3 months are very difficult months because your mind is still outside. As soon as you hit the fourth and the fifth month, you begin to forget out the outside world. You concentrate, you concentrate on where you are, the grounds in which you are. So what you simply do is you say, well, there's nothing that I can do. I just have to wait until such time that I am out of this mess.
So you just put yourself in waiting mode.
That's right.
What were you in prison for? Were you officially charged with anything?
Well, they never tell you why you are detained, but when they finally charged us, we charged with some section of the Communism Act. Now, if you look at me, I don't look like a communist, and I don't believe in communism, but I was charged under the Communism Act, and I was banned under some section of the Communism Act. Anything that you did, whether you reported about, negatively about the about South Africa, if you get arrested, you will be charged under a certain act of the Communism Act, you know.
During the apartheid era, were there assignments that you could not be sent on because you were black?
No. I refused from the very onset when the newspapers that I worked for, Drum Magazine, knew my stand. The Rand Daily Mail, which was a liberal paper, knew my stand. I did not want to be used as a token black. I did not want to go to places where I am told there were no places that I was told you can only go there and you can't go there. I told them if I'm a journalist, I should be able to go everywhere. If those people don't want me, it is up to them. There is no assignment that was big or small for me. I have always done what I thought should be done by a human being and a proper journalist.
Did that mean that there were times you had to sneak into a place because a black person either wasn't allowed or would be too conspicuous?
Well, I have done sneaking around for a long time. I remember in Zirist, I had to hide my camera in a half a loaf of bread. This was a Leica 3F, which I hid in a half a loaf of bread to be able to cover the trial of the women protesters who were protesting against the issuing of passes to men, women, and children. The press was banned in Zirast. But we were the only newspaper that went in. This is Drum Magazine. I went in there with my cameras. I hid the camera in a half a loaf of bread. When that was done, I bought a pint of milk and put the camera inside the pint of milk and continued working. When I realized that the game might be over now, I decided to leave, and we had pictures. No other paper had pictures.
You're now taking pictures for Time magazine. What interests you most in documenting post-apartheid South Africa?
What interests me most now is the traditions. I am busy working on the vanishing cultures in South Africa, because we were made to hate ourselves by the apartheid government. Because if you dare say that you come from KwaZulu, you wouldn't be able to work in Johannesburg without the suitable permit. So because of that, we had to hate ourselves and say, no, we don't come from that area. We have nothing to do with that area. Anyone that came from a rural area would never be able to work in the city. So we never wanted to deal with ourselves. But now I find that there's so much richness in this. There's so much love and beauty in our people and their traditions. And no one has ever done the project that I am involved in now, that I know of. But I know when I'm through with it, it will be a beautiful historic document, because our children, their great, great children, will be able to see as to how and where their great parents or their parents come from.
And the book that you're referring to is Photos of Rural South African Tribes?
Yes.
Do you know what tribe your family is descended from?
Well, I'm a Zulu.
I'm wondering if any of your photographs from the past are being used now, for instance, by the Truth Commission or by other people trying to investigate crimes of the past.
Well, the June 16, 1976...
The Soweto Uprising.
Soweto Uprising. Pictures there have pictures have been used by the commission.
By the Truth Commission?
Yes. And they are still going to be used in another hearing which comes up the middle of June.
How are they used by the Truth Commission?
Well, they're used by the Truth Commission as an exhibit and also people to show the brutality of the police, what the police did when they got in there, and how people were killed.
How different is your day-to-day life and your life as a photographer? Obviously, you no longer have to hide your camera when you're on assignment.
Well, this is why one can be more artistic, because it is not shoot and run. You have the time to look at your subject. You have the time to set your subject. You have the time to think before you take. Whereas during apartheid time, you didn't have that. You had to contend with what you're doing at that time, and also worry about the police.
When you were taking pictures during the apartheid period, you had two missions. One was to document what was happening, to show people in South Africa and around the world, and the other was to preserve these images for history. What is your motivation now?
Well, I have not changed from that kind of documentation. If my government, the black government, does the same things that the Botha F.W. de Klerk government did, the apartheid government did at the time, I will still expose them. I am a journalist first, before anything. I am there to serve the public. I am there to satisfy myself, direct my camera properly so that the world can see what is happening. If the present government is not doing the same things as the apartheid government, I will do the good things they are doing and show the world.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I thank you too.
And congratulations on your award.
Thank you very much.
Peter Magubane is a winner of a Mother Jones Leica Documentary Photography Award. Photos by Magubane and other award winners are on view at the UNICEF Exhibition Gallery in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Michael Oakes plays some favorite rock and roll obscurities. He runs a huge record and music photo archives and has a new book devoted to album covers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It seems every time I read a music book or see a music documentary, the photographs come from the Michael Oakes Archive. It's the largest archive of its kind in America, with about 100,000 records and close to 2 million photographs. Oakes has a new book featuring 1,000 of the best record covers of all time from his archives. Before he turned his archive into a full-time obsession and business, he was a publicist in the record industry, and he managed the career of his brother, the late folk rock star Phil Oakes. We asked Michael Oakes to join us and bring some of his favorite early rock and roll obscurities. The first record he brought was pivotal to his record collecting career. The story behind it dates back to when he was a kid getting an allowance of 50 cents a week. That was hardly enough to buy records, so he'd use the money for bus fare to the record store, and when he got to the store, he'd steal records.
This one day I get there, and this record I have to have is a thing called Letter to an Angel by the Five Shillings, which is a very black record, and it's the kind of thing that in Columbus, Ohio, if you didn't get it the first week, it would disappear because that was not a good black market. And so I get to the store, and it was a rainy day, and there was nobody else in the record store, just me. And I was going, this is really dumb. I mean, I should turn around. This is too dangerous. I mean, you know, there's nothing else for the salespeople to do but watch me. But I couldn't leave without the records, so I did try and steal it. And they caught me at the door, and they threatened to put me in jail and all that, and actually just called my parents and told them. So anyway, I never got the record. And it took me years later to find that record. And in fact, in actuality, that record was the impetus for building the whole archives, because what happened when I came out here to Los Angeles in 1969 and took my first job as a West Coast manager of publicity for Columbia Records, I was telling somebody this story, and they told me that record is impossible to get. Now, even if you could find it, it was a $40 record, and this was 69. And I've got to have that record, so I became obsessed by it. And I finally found somebody who had it, who was willing to trade that for a rare Bob Dylan record I had. And so I finally did get it. But at the same time, as I was doing that, I realized I wanted every record I had when I was a kid. And so that became my obsession. I just spent every waking hour trading with people, going to garage sales, you name it, and eventually built up the collection to 100,000 records.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
Yeah. So, no. Mission never accomplished.
More precisely, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so one more thing before we hear the Five Shillings.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why you love this record so much.
It's just basic. It's like, it's funny, I never got to total basics. I never liked the real rural blues. I didn't like stuff that basic, but I like stuff that was more urban. So it's like it's a doo-wop group doing a very sad ballad, and it's like sort of it predates rap. I mean, we're talking probably 19, oh gosh, that would have been 56, I think, or 57. So it was a spoken black word where the guy talks the bad problems he's having with his love affair. And it's just I guess as a kid, a lot of us going through teen angst identified with the blacks as this is their pain talks to my pain, and you know, somehow growing up with that, I've never outgrown it. I mean, I've always had this black music still is more important to me than almost any other form. I think it's the more immediate and the more soulful. I think that's why they call it soul music.
Okay, well, this is Letter to an Angel by the Five Shillings from the record collection of Michael Oakes.
Do 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 da la la da la la la. As I sit here alone in blue, I can think of no one, no one but you. Honey, I remember all the wonderful times we had together, the beauty of your love, the great and priceless years gone by. This in mind,
I sit here and cry. Why, as I sit in this darkest room, can I not visualize you before me? That alone is pain. And with a fever, it drives me mad. Is there an end to all this? Will I once more have your lips to kiss? Just to see you again was all I asked.
Michael Oakes, one of the amazing things about pop culture is how you can have this incredible set of memories attached to a record, and that could be a record that nobody else knows.
That's what's scary when you said mission accomplished about the record collection. The thing I love about, I guess, most forms of collecting, but specifically this form, is this collection will never be complete. I mean, just think of every town in this country that had local records like this that you had to be in that town to hear. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, the entire world music available to everybody now. So I go into a record store and somebody says, well, here's the new John Lee Hooker from Nairobi, you know. So if they have that one, they must have five others that good. And so it's just it's voluminous and virtually never ending.
My guest is Michael Oakes, and he runs the Michael Oakes Archives, an archive of rock and roll and pop and rhythm and blues records and photographs. And his new book is called 1,000 Record Covers, and it's album jackets from the 1950s onwards. What story do you think record covers tell?
Basically, they were just a visual. It was just a graphic to sort of enhance what was on the disc, or to give you some idea of what was on the disc, or in actuality, oft times to hide what was on the disc. I mean, the thing I love about the book is putting together all the early 50s covers of black artists that had to have white people on the cover, because the rack jobbers, the people who distributed the records in the South, would not carry a record with a black person on the cover, which is shocking. But that actually went all the way through to Motown. The first Motown record covers actually had cartoon drawings that were non-racial, so you couldn't tell actually who was on the record. So there's that degree, or some of the early covers are just mind-blowing as far, I mean, they're actually works of art. I remember, and it's not just me, I know a lot of other people did this too, that like when I went to college, I decorated the entire wall with album covers. I mean, they were just incredible visuals, especially like early blues albums like the Reverend Lewis Overstreet or whatever. They were just like glimpses of pop culture Americana.
Just to clarify what you're saying, I mean, a lot of rhythm and blues and jazz performers who were black were on their own album jackets. Was it just like rock and roll type acts who were trying to cross over that had white people substituting for them?
No, it was mixed, because even like an Earl Bostick, there were always and he was jazz. There were always just drawings on the covers. It would depend. Like I guess in jazz, it was more prevalent to show the fact that it was a black artist. It wasn't so horrific. I think rock and roll being the language of the teenagers, and I think that's what they were afraid of.
My guest is Michael Oakes, who runs the Michael Oakes Archive in Los Angeles, housing about 100,000 records and close to 2 million music photos. His new book is called 1,000 Record Covers. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Back with Michael Oakes, he runs an archive of records and music photos. We asked him to bring some of his favorite early rock and roll obscurities.
When I was young, I was always intrigued by the Rumble records, and these were records in which there were two groups, and it was billed as a rumble, like the Cadillacs meet the Orioles or the Paragons right. meet the Jesters, and there'd be guys in leather jackets with chains on the cover.
Yeah,
you look at it now, and it all looks really kind of harmless and campy, but you know, it's not how it looked to me when I was nine.
Yeah, well, that's what they try to do to make this. This is either the great black threat, or this is the juvenile delinquency threat. That if you like rock and roll, you'll end up smoking reefer or wearing Levi's and leather jackets. You know.
Well, I think that sense of danger must have appealed to you too, because I know one of the records you've brought with you, one of the rarities that you've brought with you today, is called Jailbait.
Well, yeah, to go back to the original story, when I got caught stealing. After my father punished me, he felt bad about it. So he told me that when he was a kid, he couldn't afford records either. So he went to the jukebox companies and bought used records for a nickel each. And so I went to my local jukebox company in Cleveland and found a way to get a ton of records going through the house every week. Basically, I collected for charity, so I got to listen to them all before I gave them to charity. And so what the advantage of that is you weren't limited by what the local radio station was playing. And so I would just see a title. So if you can imagine a 13-year-old picking up a record that said Jailbait, and I went, well, got to check this one out. And then to put it on and find out it was as good as it was. And this is like a really obscure record by a guy named Andre Williams from, it's on the Fortune label out of Detroit. And so it's like, it's a very, very obscure record. And obviously with a title and with the storyline that it has, I mean, it's pretty obvious that it never got any airplay.
Okay, let's give it a listen. This is Jailbait.
I'm running. Yes, before it's too late. Trying to get away from that jailbait. It's a rough temptation, but a common invitation. And a good association, but a quick elimination that will take you out of circulation. Yes, I'm talking about that younger generation. So take my advice, fellas, for goodness sake. 15, 16, 17, that's jailbait. Now they swear that they're in love, that you and her are by stars above, and she's looking mighty good, just like a young girl should. We try to tell you no, and let that young girl go, but you know it all, you have yourself a ball, and now that it is too late, as you look from cell number 8, I tried to tell you, mate. Seventeen and a half is still jailbait. So tomorrow's the date for the trial of jailbait. And this you watch and see. The young girl will go free. And you'll get 1 to 3. So out the door she walks, to another man she talks. Before you can count from 1 to 8, another man in for jailbait. Mr. Judge, if you just let me go this time, I ain't gonna mess with them young girls no more. I swear I ain't gonna bother them no more, Mr. Judge. I ain't gonna bother none 15. I ain't gonna bother none 16. I ain't gonna bother none 17. I ain't gonna mess with none 18. I'm gonna leave that 20-year-old ones alone too. I'm getting me a girl about 42. If if you just believe what I say, let me go, Mr. Judge. Please, Mr. Judge, I ain't gonna bother the young girls no more. Give me a break, Mr. Judge. Please, Mr. Judge.
Yeah, wow. Who are the horn players on that? That's some pretty outside stuff they're playing at the end there.
Yeah, I know. I have no idea, actually. It's very hard. Fortune Records is this little dinky record company that some friends of mine from Cream magazine actually tracked, because Cream came out of Detroit also, tracked down Fortune. They were actually still going in the 70s, and they got some great stories. My favorite story about this guy, Andrea Williams, is that he had one hit before Jailbait. I think Bacon Fat came after Jailbait, and it got quite a decent amount of sales. And so Andrea came in to find out if he made any money, and they said no, but they lied to him and said, no, it didn't sell anything, but we think you have talent, so save up enough money and come back when you have enough money to pay for another session.
Great. Those were the days.
Those were the days.
And my guest is Michael Oakes, and he runs the Michael Oakes Archives, which is a huge archive of pop music and photographs, music photographs. And these records and photographs are used for movies and documentaries and books. And you see the Michael Oakes archives attributed all over the place. And we asked him to bring some rarities with him, rare 45s. And Michael, the next record you're going to play for us, you insist, is the best female soul record ever made. What is it, and why do you make that claim for it?
Well, two reasons. One is, I think the best soul singers usually came from the church. And especially the best female soul singers, and Lorraine Ellison is no exception. She came from the church, and after she didn't make it in pop music, went back to the church. And there's a guy named Jerry Ragavoy, who was one of the unsung heroes of rock and roll, who was this brilliant producer arranger who found her, and he was doing some work for Warner Brothers, and there was this big Frank Sinatra session booked with a full orchestral. There was a full orchestra book for this Sinatra session, and Sinatra canceled at the last minute. So they had access to all this, and so they put Lorraine Ellison in with this full orchestra, and she just cuts loose on this song called Stay With Me. And it's like she starts out intense, and then she gets more intense, and you go, well, she can't top that. And then she tops it again.
Why don't we hear it? This is Stay With Me, Lorraine Ellison.
Maybe I was too good to
really pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the same pain that Vincent van Gogh could express on canvas. I mean, it's the same thing to me. It's or as my brother said, you know, do you have a picture of the pain? And you know, there it is in 3 minutes and some seconds.
Your brother, the late Phil Oakes.
Yeah.
I can't help but think that Janis Joplin must have heard that record because I think Cry Baby seems really patterned on it.
No, you know, it's funny. Actually, on this album, there's another song that that Joplin did cover, Try, which is on the same album that this one is on. And so Joplin definitely heard it and covered the other song. And on this song was covered, unfortunately, by Bette Midler in The Rose, which is where you get the Joplin tie-in. But unfortunately, Bette Midler is a little too Vegas-y vanilla for my taste.
My guest is Michael Oakes, who runs the Michael Oakes Archive, housing about 100,000 records and close to 2 million music photos. His new book is called 1,000 Record Covers. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Oakes, he runs an archive of records and music photos. We asked him to bring some of his favorite early rock and roll obscurities. You once hoped that you'd be able to hear every rock and roll record ever made.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you've even got a chance to hear every rock and roll record in your own collection.
No. No, unfortunately, because everything as one gets older is an either-or choice. When I was younger, I was driven enough to do whatever it took to stay up all night, and I mean, every spur moment was either getting the records or listening to them. And as one gets older, one is more into travel and books and all the other stuff. So now it's a balance. In fact, for a few years, I lost interest totally, and now I'm actually getting back into it because there are enough people like Matthew Sweet or Freddie Johnston, or you know, there's enough stuff that's really hitting my hot buttons again that are going, okay, got to get back into a heavy listening binge.
Michael, let's get to another rarity that you've brought with you, and this is a gospel group called the Fairfield Four. Tell us about them and when this was recorded.
Okay, this was recorded in the late 40s, and this will give you a good idea where rock and roll really came from. I mean, it wasn't rhythm and blues. It was really gospel and blues that created rock and roll. And this is like, it's got one of the best bass singers I've ever heard. And the song's called Let's Go, so it's a great exit song. And it's incredibly rocking for just a straight, good old gospel tune.
Let's hear it.
Well, come on and let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go to the land where milk and honey flow.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go to the better land I know. Where my friends and loved ones waiting me. You're in that land I long to see.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Great bass line there.
Isn't that? That was before they could afford instruments.
Well, Michael Oakes, thank you so much for sharing some of your recordings with us and talking with us about your new book. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry.
Michael Oakes runs the Michael Oakes Archive of Records and Photographs. His new book is called 1,000 Record Covers. We'll close with a record by his late brother, Phil Oakes. Fresh Air was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, I'm just a typical American boy from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd and I keep an old Castro down. And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat and my feet are flat and my asthma's getting worse.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.